And welcome to the final lecture in our 2025 Senate Lecture Series. My name's Jackie Morris. I'm the Deputy Clerk of the Senate. We're meeting today at Parliament House, which is on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I'd like to acknowledge their elders past, present and emerging. I also extend our acknowledgement to any First Nations people who are joining us today in the audience. Today's lecture will be live streamed on the APH website, so welcome to those of you who are joining us that way. And if time permits, we'll have a Q&A session for members of the audience. So if you listen to the lectures, you might be wanting to think, well, what's a point you can tease out afterwards? It's my pleasure to introduce our two presenters today, former Senators Trish Crossan AM and Gary Humphries AO. Our first speaker is Trish Crossan. Trish represented the Northern Territory in the Senate from 1998 to 2013 and was the first woman to represent the NT in the federal parliament. During her time in the Senate, she held positions as chair of the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee, deputy whip, and a temporary chair of committees. She's now the chair of the Gordon Institute of TAFE in Victoria and a director on a number of boards in the not-for-profit sector. Would you please join me in welcoming Trish Crossan?
Thanks, Jackie. Good afternoon, everyone. It's certainly been an honour to be invited to present this lecture today and to come back into this building where I spent so many hours and days of my life. But I want to begin by also acknowledging the Ngunnawal people, the traditional custodians of the land we're gathering on today, and to acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of the ACT. I also want to acknowledge and welcome any other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be attending today's event. So 50 years of the Territories in the Senate commemorating that, but my lecture says maybe not celebrating it to the point we would anticipate if you live in the Northern Territory. The journey to representation in the federal parliament for residents in the ATC, in the NT and the ACT rather, has been long, controversial and was arduous for many, many years. To kick off, I just want to quickly recap how the Territory residents even got representation in this place. But I, for full or more explanatory detail, Michael Sloan's paper that's on the Parliamentary Library's website is a fantastic piece of work. But even the path to gaining a seat in the House of Representatives for people in the Territories took decades, but with very little controversy in comparison to the efforts to get representation in the Senate. So up until 1910 or 11, the ACT and the NT were created and residents were actually represented in New South Wales or in the South Australian parliaments respectively. But in the process of being transferred to the Commonwealth, they were stripped of all political rights, had no representation in the federal parliament and had no form of local government. Finally, the Northern Territory was given a seat in the House of Representatives in 1922, and in the ACT in 1948, although these representatives still didn't have full voting rights until 1968 and 1966 respectively, so some 40 and 20 more years later. So let's have a look at the path to Senate representation. The Senate has regularly been portrayed as the state's house. The original intention was to protect the interests of the six original states and hence the reason why they shared the same number of elected senators, despite the fact that the population differs widely and still does. The idea that the two mainland territories, ACT and NT, might want a seat in the Senate led to much angst and that their inclusion would upset the concept and undermine the notion that the Senate was truly a state's house. Senator Edward Russell introduced a bill in 1920 to give the Northern Territory one spot in the Senate, and that person being elected every 3 years, but with no voting rights in the chamber. Most argued, and in fact amended the bill successfully, to propose that the NT attach itself to South Australia for Senate representation. But even that bill, after being amended, was defeated. So it was not until 1968, when Gough Whitlam tabled further legislation, that the issue was raised again, this time based on electoral fairness, the increase in population numbers, which seems to be a recurring marker when it comes to the Senate. And I want to come back to that later. Whitlam's proposal was that two senators from each territory be elected to keep the major political parties equally represented, but only in terms in line with the House of Representatives, that is, up for election every 3 years. Of course, that's still the case today. But from 1968 and over the years to follow, constitutional arguments were raised over the actual clauses in the Constitution and how they were meant to be or should be interpreted when it came to the territories and Senate representation. So what was the controversy during those 6 years, and does it still apply today? So originally, as we know, the Senate was designed to protect, whatever that meant, the interests of the states. One needed to ensure that the less populous states, like Tasmania, had the same fair go as New South Wales, hence the reason for all of the original six states having the same number of senators. The historic mantra of states' rights and whether or not the territories could or should have representation in the Senate were the topics of much debate and controversy, and not an easy passage to obtain. Finally, representation in the Senate began when the Parliament passed the Senate Representation of Territories Act in 1973. During the historic joint sitting of Parliament in 1974, each territory was to be represented by two senators. But the legislation granting territory representation was not such an easy passage after all. It survived not one, but two High Court challenges. The High Court was asked to rule on the provision that specifies the representation of the states in the Senate, but also gives the Parliament absolute discretion in deciding how this applies to the territories. Perhaps Gough Whitlam was right when he made the comment on the conflict between sections 7 and sections 122 of the Constitution when he said, "I've consulted the academics in the field, and the view which they unanimously express is that section 122, being the latter, and more specific, actually just extends the provision of section 7. So, territory representation in the Senate, as noted in Odger's Australian Senate practice, hasn't changed since, not in 50 years. The states, however, have had an increase in their numbers, of course, twice, in fact, in 1975 to 10 and in 1984 to 12. But this imbalance in terms of population has also received much criticism, such as the infamous term unrepresentative swill by one of the country's finest prime ministers, a saying that was prompted by the political alliances that dominate the Senate, where legislation is decided by the majority of political parties rather than the original stated in purpose to protect the state's interests. So today, I actually want to look ahead. We can look back, but let's look ahead and see where we might be come the next 50 years. So as noted in the report of the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters in 2023, following their inquiry into the conduct of the 2022 federal election, that report said while one vote, one value, and proportional representation are often considered together, they do not mean the same thing. The Senate is a perfect example of the difference between those two concepts. The report went on to say it is not possible to apply the principle of one vote, one value to the Senate because all the original states were given the same number of senators as a compromise to bring smaller states into the Federation at the time the Constitution was framed. Fair enough, you might think. The report concluded and recommended, though, that the representation of the territories in the Senate be increased from 2 to 4 senators each. And as we commemorate and acknowledge that this month sees the NT and the ACT represented in the Senate for 50 years, what of the future? In March this year, the government responded to the Joint Standing Committee's report and said, whilst the government has not proposed to increase the representation for the territories in the Senate at this time, this important issue requires further inquiry and consideration in conjunction with any inquiry into the membership and size of the House of Representatives. Why? The number of senators from the territories is not linked to the number of senators from the states, nor is it linked to the number of House of Representatives seats. The Coalition, of course, totally disagreed with the recommendation, arguing that increasing the number of territory senators would be the greatest level of malapportionment since Federation, and that any increase to the number of territory senators should only be considered in relation to increases in the number of senators and House of Representatives members more broadly. Their stated rationale went to comparing the total population of this country in relation to only the 36 senators elected in 2022 across 6 states and the 2 territories, although, as in the past, one may suspect that once again, partisan interests were at play. The facts are that increasing the number of senators for the territories would have, in fact, no impact at all on the increase in the size of the House. Section 24 of the Constitution states, "The House of Representatives shall be composed of members directly chosen by the people of the Commonwealth, and the number of such members shall be, as practical, twice the number of senators. The number of members chosen in the several states shall be in proportion to the respective numbers of their people." The High Court ruled in 1977 that the words "in proportion to the respective numbers of their people" meant Section 24 involved only state senators, state populations, in the calculation of the House seats. Territory senators and territory populations were not included in that formula. The number of House members from the states is dependent on territory representation. Any increase in the number of territory senators leaves the House, the numbers in the House members unchanged. Senator Pocock recommended that the government should legislate that the baseline of representation for ACT and NT in the Senate be more than one third and less than two thirds of the current state's numbers, so an allocation of between 5 and 7. He also went on to say that this should start at halfway with the ACT and the NT and landed on a figure of 6. Terms would also increase to 6 years and commence on 1 July. Following the election in line with the states, that would mean that 3 senators would be up for election every 3 years. It would give every senator the same 6-year term as every other senator in every other state. And while an increase in 6 senators would be welcomed, I can't quite see that that would be a first step, possibly a leap too far. So, what are my thoughts? I want to leave you with what it's like representing the Northern Territory when there are only 2 of you in this House, in the Senate. I'm going to propose that the increase should go immediately to 4 senators. It's long overdue, and a very serious consideration should be given to change the current situation before the next election There is time to do that. Still having two elected each time, but ensuring that your term as a Territory Senator from the Territories is aligned to every second federal election. So in essence, as I said, a six-year term similar to those elected from the states, two senators at a time. So let's just look at the pure fairness of the rights of people in the Northern Territory when it comes to electoral representation in the Senate. I want to paint a picture of trying to represent and service people in the NT when you are here in this place. There's only two of you. History shows that it's usually one from each of the major parties. So in reality, one from your political party in the Senate to cover a huge geographical distance. The ratio of people to the number of senators has always been higher, always higher, than the smaller state. Remember, the Constitution treats all the states the same when it comes to Senate representation, but not on the number of their population. So let me just take you back to 1975. Tasmania in 75 had a population of around 410,000 people. That was one senator for every 41,000 people. The Northern Territory had a population of 105,000 people, one senator for every 52,500 people. This year, in 2025, Tasmania has a population of about 576,000 people. That's one senator for every 48,000 people. Remember that? The Northern Territory this year has a population of nearly 264,000 people. That's one senator for every 132,000 people. The territory is 1.4 million square kilometres. Three major cities, Darwin, Palmerston, Alice Springs. Four major regional centres, hundreds of kilometres apart, and over 50 remote communities, Indigenous communities, where some now have a burgeoning population of over 4,000 people, Gullawinku, Manangreta, Wadai. And yet the distance from Darwin to Alice Springs, about 1,500 kilometres, is just under Melbourne to Sydney return, or about 300 kilometres short of Melbourne to Brisbane. Driving long distances or flying in small charter aircraft is the only way you can get to their community. But more importantly, it's usually the only way constituents can get to actually see, talk and engage with their federal representatives. In comparison, Tasmania is 68,000 square kilometres. You can actually drive from one end of the island to the other in less than a day. So Territory Senators are also only entitled to one electorate office. So that's usually based in Darwin, and it's extremely difficult to meet constituent in Alice Springs or vice versa. The other major city, of course, which you would go to on a regular basis. But where do you meet them? Cafes, hotel lobbies. They operate as temporary offices and very unacceptable when you're assisting someone with very sensitive issues. At the very least, this government should look at improving office access so there's no appetite to increase the number of senators immediately, at least increase their ability to access their constituents fairly across the 1.4 million square kilometres. So most of the opposition to increasing the number of senators in the territories comes from the prediction of the political outcomes and the contests that would occur. In September 2023, Anthony Green did an analysis of this using an increase of what would happen with four and six senators elected at each election, finding it that it could disrupt the traditional duopoly that exists, especially for territory senators in the NT. The ACT would be, of course, we've seen, far more interesting and difficult to predict, as Senator Pocock, of course, has already destroyed that duopoly. But, however, you shouldn't get bogged down. I don't believe you should get bogged down in political arithmetic. To me, equal and fair representation, access to your elected representatives should never be based on which political party may seek to gain out of any change. As we have seen over recent years, the political landscape is changing. Representation in the Senate has varied regularly, but people's rights to have regular and equitable contact with the elected members should not be traded off. So let me conclude by reminding you that the territories are not protected in the Constitution. With visionary and fair and good policy, the rights of people in either the NT or the ACT, or even their self-government, is simply all at the mercy of a piece of legislation and therefore the political composition of the Parliament at the time. Increasing the number of territory elected senators will not interfere with the balance of the House of Representatives seats. So the matter should be considered separately, and any proposal to increase the size of the Parliament as a whole is quite another separate matter. So let's hope at the next historical milestone, where we celebrate, hopefully, territory and ACT representation in the Senate in this place, that the event in this democracy of ours, whether it's in 5, 20 or even 50 years, we're still not standing here arguing why the NT should have more than 2 senators, that we are celebrating, in fact, better and greater representation in the Senate for people, especially from the NT. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Trish. It's now my great pleasure to welcome Gary Humphries, who is our second speaker. Gary was a member of the ACT Legislative Assembly from 1989 to 2003, and during this time he served in many different ministerial roles. He was also the Chief Minister from 2000 to 2001, and from 2003 to 2013 he was the Liberal Senator for the ACT. In that role he held various shadow ministerial responsibilities. Now, interestingly enough, he's taken up being a PhD student at ANU and is writing the first history of ACT self-government. Please join me in welcoming Gary Humphries.
Thank you very much, Jackie. To Trish and ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the privilege of being able to talk to the Australian community, particularly the community here in Canberra, about this auspicious occasion, the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the right of territories to be represented in the Senate. There have been a number of people who've had the privilege of being representatives of the territories in the Senate, and I feel privileged, as I'm sure Trish does, to have been asked to present these this lecture today. I, as you've heard, am a student myself these days, and a history student, and so I'll be spending a little more time talking about the history of the process whereby the territories became represented. I'll also be touching particularly on that very significant joint sitting of the federal parliament when the territories were given that privilege that Trish has mentioned already. And I'll be reflecting on how, as Trish has done, on how the changing nature of politics, the breakdown of the two-party system, will affect Senate representation in the future and what it means for the dynamics of a changing electorate and changing expectations of our democratic system. As Trish has outlined, there's been an argument long run about the state's house not needing to include within its representation people from the territories, and the arguments that have been used in that respect were very much ventilated at that joint sitting in 1974, and I'll come back to that. But I think that the opposition to the idea of representation, first in the House of Reps and then in the Senate, was rooted very much on opposition based on ambivalence about the two territories, particularly, I might say, about Canberra. Obviously, of course, Canberra was an invention of federation. It was a compromise to woo particularly a recalcitrant New South Wales. And the first referendum, New South Wales voted against federation and took the second one where it had been incentivised to support the idea of federation by having the national capital promised to be within its boundaries but not less than 100 miles from Sydney. And so Canberra was always a political football in that sense. And from the very beginning, its very purpose was contested and argued about. So different early politicians saw it in an entirely different way. Deakin, interestingly, saw Canberra as almost as a temporary city, one that would be populated by politicians and public servants when Parliament was sitting and be largely evacuated and kind of left, you know, just with a caretaker or a few people looking after it when Parliament wasn't sitting, very much a token capital. King O'Malley had a much more expansive view about the city. He famously said that he saw one day that it would, quote, rival London in population, Paris in beauty, Athens in culture, and Chicago in enterprise. We haven't quite got there yet, but we're still working on it. It still might happen. Move over London. Okay. But that residual kind of ambivalence about Canberra, you know, the sense as it grew, people became a little more cynical, because it didn't grow very much. It was still only 40-odd thousand people into the 1950s. When there were difficult decisions, when there were things people didn't agree with, they would blame Canberra for that fact. And that hostility, that kind of resentment, which occurs in most countries where you've got a national capital at some distance from where you live, was compounded in the case of Canberra by the coalition's residual ambivalence about this city. I think many coalition MPs, of course not initially a coalition, but other parties and then the Liberal and National parties, or Liberal and Country parties initially, they shared some of the ambivalence, the animosity of people in states towards this unpopular manufactured concept of a federal city. They were suspicious, the coalition was suspicious about Canberra as a progressive community, more left-wing than the rest of the country. Menzies famously was unwilling to see more representatives because he was afraid that the, quote, militant voice in the parliament would become more dominant. And there was also a view that Canberra belonged to the nation. It was a national responsibility and the people of Canberra shouldn't have any more say in its running than people in Brisbane, Melbourne or Sydney. And interestingly, that view was exploited by a federal Liberal minister, Bob Ellicott, in 1978 when a referendum was held here on whether the ACT should be self-governing. And Ellicott fairly clearly, although he'd set up the referendum, engineered the animosity towards the city in the sense that it was a national responsibility to help defeat the referendum and ensure that Commonwealth stewardship continued. He wanted Canberra to be a showcase for federal activities, a federal building of a showcase city. So the time when the AIS, the Nolan Gallery, a new convention centre were being built, and of course this building was coming into being as well. So, or soon after that. And that ambivalence extended not just to federal coalition MPs, but also to a large extent to the citizens themselves. Whereas I think it's true to say that citizens of the Northern Territory were always pretty keen on being self-responsible and having self-government, in the ACT they were positively not keen on that idea. In 1978, as I said, that referendum was held. It overwhelmingly voted against change. People wanted the federal government to keep looking after them. And the argument after the 70s became really, well, whether it's a federal responsibility or not, we know that this city has been lavishly endowed by federal government, and that the bean counters are looking at how much is being spent on the ACT. We don't want that to be cut back, and we know that self-government will be a vehicle for reductions in Commonwealth outlays to the ACT. Which leads to an interesting question. I mean, if you had to describe, and speaking as a member of the Canberra Liberals, if you had to describe what person was most responsible for the growth and development and success of the Canberra Liberals, what politician, I wonder who you would say it would be. If anyone in the audience wants to guess who would be the person most responsible for that success? Anybody? No, I don't think Menzies could claim that. Under Menzies, the Liberal Party did quite poorly. It struggled to win any seats in the old advisory council. It never came anywhere near winning a seat in the House, the one seat in the House of Representatives. Any other guesses? He's been mentioned already. Gough Whitlam. Gough Whitlam was an incredible fillip to the success of the Liberal Party in the ACT. He, of course, came to office promising a form of self-government for the ACT, didn't quite deliver that, but promised it at least. The Whitlam government was so unpopular in Canberra by the middle of 1974 that when the election for the Advisory Council, which was now called the Legislative Assembly, was held, for the first time ever, Liberal MLAs outnumbered Labor ones, which was an astonishing turn of events and changed the outlook of the party very much. In the following year, in 75, as we've heard, the territories were granted representation in the Senate, and the very first federal representative of the Liberal Party in the ACT was elected, John Knight. Not only was he one of two senators elected, but he was the first senator elected in that race, beating Susan Ryan to the very first, the distinction of being the very first ACT senator. At the same time, a Liberal was elected to the House of Representatives in the form of John Haslam in the seat of Canberra, and a party which had languished hopelessly before that point was suddenly in serious contention. In fact, so much so that the following year, in 1976, the Liberal Party, the ACT Liberals, who had been a branch or set of branches of the New South Wales division of the party, were made a separate division of the party, with the first president being Margaret Reid. And again, a few years later, another Labor government, the Hawke government, granted the ACT self-government. But this was a different kettle of fish. Territory citizens were quite happy to have senators because it gave them extra voices at the federal table where decisions were being made about the city, but they didn't have to take any responsibility for those decisions. They were still made by the federal government. Now, with local politicians, the territory was taking local responsibility and bearing the cost of the city in due course. So that's a little of the history I wanted to run through. But let me describe how I think territory representation in the Senate has changed the nature of politics in Canberra. At first, it made very little difference. I think John Knight shared the load with John Haslam of representing this city, which had swung recently into the Liberal Party's orbit. But in other ways, the coalition, which had previously resisted the idea of there being territory senators, found new senators quite useful. So the territory senators tended to be the people chosen to be the whips. So John Knight became the coalition whip in the Senate. When he died in 1981, he was succeeded by Bernie Kilgariff, another territory senator from the other territory. And when he finished up, Margaret Reid became became the whip in the Senate. So it was useful to have a person on the ground in Canberra as the government whip or the opposition whip, as the case may be. There was a significant workload for those senators, though. As Trish has indicated, There's a level of responsibility that goes with being a senator in a context like this, which does give you a burden of responsibility well in excess of what other senators in the states have to bear. You can blend into the background as a senator for New South Wales and Victoria if you really want to. Very hard to do that in the case of the two territories. And after 1980, when John Haslam lost his seat, the Territory Liberal Senator became the only representative of the Conservative side of politics in the National Parliament. Margaret Reid, for example, there she is there with her portrait that hangs in the Members Hall, the only Territory Senator to become a presiding member. She was the Senate President of the Senate, the first woman President of the Senate. It's her official portrait. Trish and I don't have a portrait, but we're available for a sitting if anyone's available to paint it. She was famous for working the electorate as hard as a local member would. Every school fete, every Indian dance night, every school end of year function, she was there. And that came with the job. She had to work hard to keep her constituents represented. The other thing which, in the case of the ACT, I think made it hard to not be effectively an MHR in all but name is a couple of historians, Richard White and Benedict Anderson, have described as imagined communities, where if you live in, say, Dubbo, you know that the state government is in Sydney. You might have visited Sydney, but you're unlikely to have spent much time in Macquarie Street. Much of the mechanics of how your state is run is filled in by what you read or see on TV or your imagination. And people embroider that imagination with lots of different ideas, some of, you know, idealistic views about what politics should be about, or maybe very cynical views, but it's distorted by having to not have direct experience of what they're seeing. Now, that's not so much the case in the ACT. People live right in the centre of the national government. They see what's going on. They mix with the MPs and senators who come here when they go to the supermarket and see them there shopping for their toothpaste or whatever. There's a sense of immediacy there. And many people, of course, here work in the federal government. And so we have a very politically literate, physically proximate electorate where people understand the issues, and the shibboleths, the shortcuts to, you know, slogans that pass for politics in some other places won't wash in the ACT. People want you to tell them what's going on. And if you make a mistake, they will pull you up in the street or the queue for the cinema or wherever at the petrol station and tell you where you've gone wrong. So that sense of, you know, the people are there, they know what's happening and they're going to tell you about it is very real. So on a number of issues, Territory Senators have had to step up to the plate and be at the forefront of debates. One of those, of course, in recent years for both territories was the question about euthanasia and whether the territory should be allowed to have euthanasia. Northern Territory led the way. The ACT was going to follow suit, I think, in the early 90s when this happened, and the federal parliament intervened to override that. And there was a powerful reaction, including from the Territory Senators, to that, and they could not help but be part of that debate. Another occurred later when the ACT Legislative Assembly passed the Civil Unions Act in 2006, which was not quite same-sex marriage, but it was all but same-sex marriage. And the federal government decided to override the ACT in having done this, even though Tasmania had done something pretty close to that a few years beforehand and, of course, couldn't be overridden because it was a state. And that caused me to have to cross the floor and vote against the government, making me the only Liberal senator to cross the floor in the life of the Howard government. I think if I'd been a senator in a state and I'd had the same view, I wouldn't have been thrust into that position of having to make that decision. But in the territory, I knew it would be very hard to vote in favour of that or to refused to disallow that piece of legislation and then face the people I was going to see in the street when I went for a coffee or went shopping or whatever. There would be a view about that, and that sense that the senator is right there at the coalface of politics would be very much in evidence. I think senators have become, territory senators have become a very important vehicle for broadening the debate in the ACT's case about the ACT's needs. They've been at the forefront of debates about infrastructure. When the Chogham meeting was moved a few years back from Canberra to Brisbane, the senators were right there arguing the case against that. Taxation issues in the territory, the fact the Commonwealth pays no payroll tax on its payroll here, and of course territory rights. And that has made the job of being a territory senator very, very much more arduous. I wanted to, as I said, I did promise I'd come back and just talk a little bit more about the 1974 dissolution, joint sitting. And I do this because, as it happens, my thesis supervisor, Frank Bongiorno, has written a marvellous article with Josh Black about that joint sitting and bears some reading. It's a really entertaining account. I just wanted to read a few quotes from that article about the joint sitting. Just to set it in context, of course, the two houses are sitting together. Never happened before. They're trying to work out, you know, who presides and how speakers are arranged and all sorts of things, where people sit. It was very awkward. And the second piece of legislation considered was the legislation to give the territory senators. And a few quotes from that. 12 months earlier, Snedden, who was, of course, the Liberal leader, had asked former Prime Minister John Gorton to advise him how to handle this proposal. Though personally dismissive of the reform and cognizant of likely complaints from the states that the representation would be watered down, Gorton said it was a matter of political judgment as to whether the Liberal Party ought to oppose it and said, on balance, I see little benefit in us doing so. His advice was ignored. So the debate got underway. Senators are working out what to say about this. They're all on their best behaviour, though, because this was also the very first time the Parliament was broadcast on television. It was recorded in colour, but, of course, people didn't have colour TVs at that stage, so it was received on people's homes in black and white. And because it was all very unfamiliar, people were quite well behaved, relatively speaking. In the course of the debate, Bongiorno and Black say, Attorney General Lionel Murphy, decked out in a navy suit and purple shirt-tie combination, said the privilege of electing representatives to the Senate has been exercised by voters in six states since Federation. It should be a privilege open to all Australian voters, whether they live in states or territories, as Trish said before. Liberal Senator, Senator Greenwood, warned that this would weaken the power of the Senate and deny to the states the voice which our federal compact sought to give them. Referring to the Labor Party's aim of eventually abolishing the Senate, which was then Labor Party policy, of course, Greenwood framed the inclusion of Territorians in the Senate as an underhand means whereby the influence of the Senate is sought to be reduced. Further quote, the conservatively coiffed senator argued the opposition case passionately, but the day's proceedings appear to have lost their novelty by this time. Members began to leave the chamber, and even the bewigged clerk of the Senate appeared to be rubbing his face wearily. Coalition senators used the well-worn tactic of throwing any argument, however unlikely, against the proposal with the object of turning something rather simple and innocuous into a matter fraught with trouble and danger. One was that the Senate would be swamped with representatives of other Australian territories. In a sauntering presentation, the tanned Andrew Peacock, whose large gold wristwatch reflected the intense lighting back into the camera lenses, asked how the government would deal with the people of the many other territories beyond the mainland. Quote, what are the government's proposals for the people of Cocos Islands who have opted for Australian citizenship? Indeed, what are its proposals for Norfolk Island or the other territories in Australia? The spectre he conjured seemed perilously close to a scare campaign about penguins from the Australian Antarctic Territory sending some of their own to share the red leather seats with human counterparts. Another line of attack was that the government would legislate so that instead of two, there would be 10 or 50 representatives from each of the territories. The Country Party's Ian Sinclair argued that Parliament could end up with not a state's house but a territory's house. Jim Killen delivered one of the standout performances of the event. He began by likening the enthusiasm of the Labor Party for territory representation in the Senate to that of the early apostles, at which Whitlam, Doug McClelland, Fred Daly and Frank Crean, who had no role in any of the debates, could be seen chuckling. Disarming government senators with sparkling put-downs, Killen said it would be a desperately unrewarding exercise to present a rational argument to Tony Mulvihill, another senator, and that his fellow Queensland Senator George George's attempt at an interjection was, quote, the most sustained display of activity we have seen from him since he came here, end of quote. With much hand-waving and rostrum thumping, he argued that legislative changes to the composition of the Senate would mean that the entire, quote, entire constitutional structure can be broken down and could lead to a very sorry, desperate state of affairs. The reply fell to Jim McClelland, a smooth and fashionable Labor senator from New South Wales, whose nickname was Diamond Jim, who had only narrowly missed out on a place in the ministry following the election. Quote, I'm grateful to the previous speaker, Killen, who, no matter how abhorrent his politics, never manages to be dull. Now, the occasion of this vote caused a problem for the sole member of the Northern Territory, Sam Calder. He felt conflicted because he'd been arguing for more representation for the Northern Territory for some time. In the end, he announced that he would be crossing the floor and voting for the government's bill. Two divisions were held to determine the fate of the bills, and the chamber rang with the sound of dozens of conversations as the tellers counted heads. Whitlam and Cairns were once again huddled in conversation at the table, as were Snedden and Shadow Minister Tony Street opposite him. Steele Hall, who was the Liberal Movement breakaway senator from South Australia, who himself had been dealing with malapportionment in South Australia, perched himself uncomfortably on the edge of one of the government's benches. Calder, from the Northern Territory, as if to reiterate his discomfort about voting with the government, sought permission from Cope, the chair, to sit on the floor rather than on a government bench, because he was so politically and philosophically opposed to them, that is, the government. And they add, as a last remark, in the 1980s, when Whitlam was compiling material for a prime ministerial memoir, he asked his research officer, a university student from Western Sydney named Mark Latham, to draw up a balance sheet of the government's policy record. How much of the program had been left untouched by Whitlam's successors? And Latham came back with just three things. One vote, one value. That was another bill that went through at the same time to reduce the level of disparity between the size of seats. Regular redistributions of electorates and senators for the territories. So a very interesting account, as they point out, somewhat overshadowed by the events of the following year in 1975, but still really a very interesting episode in Australian politics. One which I have to say, as a former Territory Senator who saw none of those arguments against Territory Senators come to anything like fruition, a salutary lesson in a party to think about the, you know, how somebody sitting in a kitchen in Brisbane might react to an argument rather than thinking about the judgment of history on these things. So saying none of these arguments have stood the test of time. And I think, with respect, any territory, any senators still around from those days, and there are very few, would have to be a little bit cringing about the sort of things that were put forward. Let me conclude by making a couple of comments about the future. People in the Capital Territory have shown their willingness to swim against the national tide very often. The Territory was the only electorate jurisdiction to vote for the Republic in 1999, the only one to vote for the Voice to Parliament in 2023, and so often have taken a different course to the rest of Australia. it's persistently preferred minority governments in the ACT Legislative Assembly over a period of more than 35 years. That contrariness was demonstrated again in 2022 with the election of an independent to the Senate. And in 2025, by choosing that same independent as the first elected senator for the ACT, the first time since 1975 that the Labor Party was pushed into second place in the race. ACT voters have always been very strategic, some would say mercenary, about using their vote to get what they want. That strategic approach, I think, will continue into the future, most particularly in relation to the vote for future territory senators, by which I mean that voters will reshape the nature of politics in an age when there is a crisis of confidence in the very institution of democracy. I believe democracy can be saved by being overhauled, by being restructured. And in the ACT's case, that overhaul can be achieved from the bottom up, by the voters changing the nature of things, rather than from the top down. Political parties in this scenario will need to live without majorities, with greater levels of accountability, and with sharing power on occasions, either within formal coalitions or on an informal basis. The PR system of electing senators assists with this dynamic of reform, but as the old system breaks down, the dynamic can work in other contexts too. For example, at the last election, the seat of Bean very nearly went to an independent with a single-member electorate arrangement in place. So we need to accept that change is an inevitability, and we need, as citizens, to be engaged with the debate about where that change should go and be prepared to direct it. And I think that in the future, representation in the territory, in the Senate from the territory, will be part of that process of change. Thank you very much.
I think it was very interesting. It's always interesting hearing from practitioners and not just and putting, you know, some historical context, which both of you did, was wonderful. It was interesting particularly to think that you had problems with the proximity of your constituents and you had the reverse problem,
yes,
the lack of proximity.
That's right.
Yes, so,
exactly.
So it's quite a contrasting experience in a way. Mm. We've got a microphone, so if there are questions from the floor, if you could put your hand up, and there's one at the back there.
Good afternoon, Kim Rubenstein. Very much appreciated the presentation and matters that are very dear to my own personal, professional interests and heart. Two things that I think are interesting to flow from both of your discussions. Gary, I like very much the ending of the rethinking of structures to reinvigorate representative democracy, and many of you will have heard me speak about other ideas around that in terms of joint job sharing in Parliament and joint sharing of power in a single seat. But the other aspect is, of course, as you've ended with territory representation. I wonder if your imagined community, you mentioned Norfolk Island, the ACT is responsible for the Norfolk Island, and so that imagined community has its stresses, and perhaps Trish's point about having a place in the in Norfolk Island for the senators to be able to meet their constituents there. I went to Norfolk Island when I was running in 2022, and it was an interesting experience to get a sense of the breadth of who the ACT senators are responsible for. Mm. But I guess my question is whether we should be a bit more hopeful, because the 2025 review of the election has actually discussed increasing the numbers of the Parliament broadly, and myself and many others have returned to the territory representation aspect as a way of taking advantage of that. I totally agree with you, Trish, that that's not relevant in conceptually, but the partisan nature and the politics of it may be that this is in fact the moment for it to happen by virtue of the fact that the Parliament is, or the government has an appetite for increasing Parliament more broadly. Mm. So it would be harder to resist increased territory representation if you're taking this step of increasing the Parliament more broadly, and I wonder if you're more hopeful about that.
Oh, my response is you can increase the number of senators
with a piece of legislation next February, frankly.
You're absolutely right.
And the numbers in the House in relation to state senators is a totally different matter. Just two things I want to say, and Kim, it's lovely to see you and hear from you. The Northern Territory senators also represent Christmas and Cocos Island. They're attached to the seat of Lingiari for House of Representatives. But to get to Christmas and Cocos Island, it is a 10-day turnaround trip. So you've got to go down to Perth, stay the night, get a plane to either Cocos, stay for 2 or 3 days, go on to Christmas, stay for 2 or 3 days, go back to Perth, go back to Darwin, because there's only 2 flights in and out of Christmas and Cocos every week. So, you know, whenever I wanted to go and visit them, you just had to block out a Thursday to a Sunday week. The other thing I want to say is Gary might have got stopped in the supermarket in the ACT all the time. So did I in Darwin all the time. But 50 remote communities, I'd be lucky if I got to all of them in 3 years. Because the biggest criticism Indigenous people say to you is, you just fly in, fly out. You're like blowflies. So I was very conscious that if I was going to go anywhere, I would at least stay 1 or 2 nights and not just fly in and fly out, because that's contrary to that. And let me just tell you one funny story I was saying to Gary this morning. When I was here, one of my colleagues said to me, "Oh, Crossan, what are you doing on the weekend?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to a preschool fete Saturday. I bought them a rabbit because the dogs broke in and mauled their rabbit, so I'm giving Durack preschool a rabbit. And then that afternoon, I'm going to go to the Italian festival and the Filipino festival." And he turned around and he said to me, you do know you're a senator, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." But that's the other thing people never appreciate in this place, is that territory senators are treated, and your constituents expect you and treat you like a House of Representatives member. I now live in Victoria, and to be honest with you, those 12 senators are invisible. It's only because I follow politics I know about them. But that is not the case in the territory. And if I missed one festival on a Saturday night or decided to just have one day at home with my family, you can bet your bottom dollar the next day at the butcher's someone would say to me, where were you last night? We didn't see you, you know, at the Glenty, or we didn't see you at the Cypriot Festival." And you wouldn't get that. I don't believe you would get that as much in the States. And so that's another reason. It's about sharing the load. It's about giving people more access to their federal representatives so they can tell you their gripes, their worries, their changes, their ideas for policy. Because it's almost impossible to do that and travel up and down to this place. 7 hours, remember, door to door, not 1 hour. I was never home at 9 o'clock in my bed on a Thursday night like most of other people I worked with. It's 7 hours door to door twice a week. It's a big workload.
Just to add to that, I mean, I think Trish has already outlined very well why this idea of, you know, too many, 4 senators say would be too many. It wouldn't be too many at all. And it is the nature of the beast for different reasons for both territories those extra bodies on the ground would make a big difference to the effectiveness of representation of those places. Mm. And I think the idea of 2 senators elected at every election for 6-year terms would work best. It's not as given, doesn't give me options to people as 4 senators elected at every election for 3 years or 6 years, but it's less scary to the balance of things at the moment, and be more likely or less likely to be a scare campaign around it. So that's the model I would support.
I feel time has defeated us unless someone is very desperate to get in. No. Okay. Well, thank you both. I think combining that sweep across the history with the practicalities of representing people, it was really interesting. And the time you've put into preparing was very evident to us. So lovely. This is our last lecture for the year. Our first lecture in 2026 will be on the 6th of February and will be Professor Lorne Newdorf, who's looking at the potential of AI to assist in the scrutiny of bills and delegated legislation. So we'll have material about that coming out soon. Can you join me in thanking once again Trish Crossan and Gary Humphries for today's lecture?
Thanks, Jackie.
It's a very nice job.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you for the invite.
Mm. It's a real...